originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, alongside my usual entry mate here on the network, that is the pontiff of the pick for Jude Feld, taking the show on the road for you here this afternoon as we come to you from Gulfstream Park in Hallandale Beach, Florida, getting ready for the Florida Derby this weekend. And who better to visit with than trainer Dale Romans for the next hour? I think you're really going to enjoy this visit. We're going to look at the top horses that Dale has had the chance to be around. And look, you're talking about a guy who has saddled more than 1,900 winners. He won an Eclipse Award in 2012, coming on the heels of his victory in the Preakness in 2011 with Shackleford, and he's a three-time Breeders' Cup winning trainer, and we're happy to have him with us for the next hour on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you for having me. I'm a trainer that likes to talk.
Well, I didn't think we'd have any trouble filling the hour.
As long as we're talking about horses, we won't.
Can we get into some other things?
Well, we can get into other things. This is satellite, right?
This is satellite.
Talk about all you want.
He wants to be the Howard Stern of horse trainers.
Baba Booey.
How great is this setting? Just to paint the picture for our listeners, we're recording this earlier in the afternoon. Of course, people are listening to it 6 o'clock Eastern time. Sirius 219, XM 206, but we're overlooking the finish line here at Gulfstream, and it is an absolutely picture-perfect day. A bit of a breeze, temperatures in the mid-80s, plenty of sunshine. Life is good down here in South Florida, Dale Romans.
Life's always good. You know, when you grow up on the racetrack, I've never had a job in my life, I tell everybody. I mean, people pay to come here, I hear, and bet on horses and watch them run and sit by the ocean. And it's a beautiful thing.
Join me on this program. I think Jude was even part of that show back in 2012 when we were just starting with these Trainer Talk programs. You've accomplished so much in that time frame since 2012, but you think about everything you've accomplished in your career. We talked about getting started. We talked about your dad and being around the racetrack from the time you were a little kid to see where your career is today. 1,900 winners.
February 15th this year was the 30th anniversary of my first win at Turfway Park. And it was Maiden 3500, Miss Mindy, Laura Hernan in the Irons, who still works with me today and runs pretty much my entire life, the office and everything we do. 30 years, Maiden 35, and on the anniversary, I won a Maiden 12.5. So I think I did pretty well. I went up four rungs in 30 years.
That's a classic.
Could you imagine it would end up where it has?
No. Every stage of my career, I've thought, this is enough. If I won from the first win I had, at least I had my trainer's name on the program and I won a race, to winning my first stake with Morning Punch at Turfway Park, at least now I'm a stakes winning trainer. Never expected for things to unfold the way I have. I always felt like I was playing trainer. And it's worked out pretty well for me. It's the only thing I've ever thought about my entire life is horse racing, and it's all I ever loved.
I was stabled next to your father at Turfway Park in 1978 when I was working for Doug Udodge, and I used to watch his action, watch his horses. He was the king of claiming horses in those days. He won practically every race he was in. People used to duck him like crazy. Were you working for him at that time?
No, 78. I didn't graduate high school till 84. And
how old do you think he is?
Yeah. I just turned.
Frankel asked me that question one time.
I just turned 50 years old. But you're right about that. He would tell you, so I'm not saying anything. He's passed away at the age of 59 early, but he would tell you he wasn't a true horseman. He was more of a handicapper and a businessman. And when you're dealing with claiming horses, that's what you need to be. And he gave me a much bigger entry level into the game. I started out as a kid working in the barn, and I tell everybody it's sort of like learning Spanish. If you grew up in Mexico or if you started walking into the racetrack at 25 like my father did and tried to learn Spanish, it just comes so much more natural, I think. But he was good. He did well, and he was good at claiming horses. And if he claimed your horse, you probably lost a pretty good horse.
What have you enjoyed most about being a horse trainer?
I think that it's such a there's such a camaraderie, and it's a fraternity of horse trainers. And we compete and maybe complain to one another back and forth, but I think we all have an understanding and empathy of what everybody goes through in this game. And it becomes a big family and an extended family. Like these other trainers' kids, I know them through my kids, and we all end up having your children with you everywhere you go. We don't take vacations. I don't think any of us take vacations, but everywhere we go, we make a vacation. We bring the family along with us. And I don't think there's any other career that you can spend as much time with your children and your family.
Who are the closest members of your training family, your racetrack family, so to speak?
It boils down to back in that corner of Churchill Downs that I grew up in. And Greg Foley is one of my greatest friends since we were kids. He was one of the guys I always looked up to. He's a few years older than me. He wouldn't want me to tell you he's 10 years older than me, but he is. But he was one that took me under his wing real early when I was just a kid and we hung out together. One of the leading trainers around Churchill for several years, and he's now clocking at the fairgrounds. He was on that corner. Angel Montana was on that corner. Bernie Flint was on that corner. And they're all guys that I looked up to and are considered close friends and still are. But out of the backside of Churchill Downs, there's five or six of us that all grew up together that are still together. Terry Miller, which is the agent for Corey Lannery as of today, and Greg Foley. And Terry's brother, Scott Miller, was our jockey that grew up with us. Rob O'Connor, that grew up right there on that corner. Vicki Foley, Greg's sister. We all just grew up together, and it is. It's in a family, and we do family things together.
Well, you know, it is those kind of things that keep you close and keep you interested, and even if you're not doing good, you've got those guys to lift you up and tell you, hey, you haven't forgot how to train. You know what you're doing. Just hang in there. Everything's going to turn around, because sometimes you forget.
You do, you can – sometimes not see the forest for the trees and not see the big picture. And like Greg and Rob O'Connor, I have extra horses that need to go where they're going that don't fit where I'm going. I send them with them. When Greg had a good horse needed to go to Saratoga, he sends it with me. Terry Miller, the agent, whoever he has is going to ride all my horses pretty much. And we make sure we have somebody we can work well together with. And it is. It's when you feel a little down, somebody will buoy you up. The racetrack used to be, and these cases still is, when one person eats, we all eat. So one person's always doing good, so they can take care of the others.
Yeah, has that happened often where you've had to lean on other people in the game, whether it's other fellow trainers or just friends? Or does that happen often with horse trainers?
I think it does. I think everybody has their little group and their little clique. But, you know, I learned a lot on the corner of Barn 4, the gap there where I've been my entire life, from all the guys I just mentioned. And I can tell you that each one of them had their strengths. And I would watch, like, Bernie Flint, there's no better managing his money and his businessman on the backside. I think him and my father were both like that. Donnie Winfrey was great with the young horses, two-year-olds. Angel, nobody could claim horses and do it any better than Angel Montana. And Greg Foley, he was a lot younger than those guys, more my peer, a few years older than me, had the best-looking horses on the track. He made sure they were all slick and happy. And I'd look at them come through there, and I said, that's how I want my horses to look. And so you learn a little bit from each other. You feed off of each other, and then you cheer for each other when you're doing good. You try to help each other when you're not doing so well.
Yeah, it's a great feeling when that happens. I'm sitting here, you know, Arnold Winnick, he took care of my brother and I for many years. And this is right about where Arnold's box was at the old Gulfstream. We'd have 2-3 horses. We'd get down, and he'd send us the rehab horses because he didn't like Randy to waste his time rehabbing. He wanted to train the good horses. And that kept Bob and I alive for a long, long time. And it's great when you have those friends and people that look after you. And, you know, Arnold would beg me for a bill. I used to love that.
Yeah. I never met him. He was pretty much retired before I got to doing the caliber of horses I could bring to Gulfstream. But I've heard that from a few different people, that how generous he was with his time and his horses. And I always thought it was a cool story. He'd fly to Ocala in a helicopter and check the babies and come back. I thought that's pretty cool.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Visiting with trainer Dale Romans on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Dale, as you began to compete on an even bigger stage and you started to travel away from Churchill Downs and your base in Kentucky, you met so many other big-name trainers and really titans of the sport, one in particular, the late Alan Jerkins, who we talked about before we even recorded this show. You were very close with Alan.
Alan was a great mentor of mine and to me the greatest American horse trainer. And you talk about a guy that would help people. He probably helped more up-and-comers on this racetrack than anybody. And one of the few guys that, I don't care who you were, he genuinely wanted to see everyone do well. and he had no resentment for someone winning. And maybe the greatest man I'd ever met.
What's your favorite Alan Jerkins story that you like to tell?
I got a lot
that
of
you can tell.
I can tell a lot of good ones, but you know, I've just told earlier about what a tough game training horses is, and I was sitting with him one day out by the racetrack watching horses train here at Gulfstream, and he was on the phone, and I could tell he was getting a little aggravated and a little frustrated. He's 80 years old, and he hangs up the phone, and he looked at me, and he said, "When do you get your wings?" And I thought, man, this is what I got to look forward to for the next 30 years, trying to get my wings, if he doesn't have them yet. But there was, we had a lot of fun together, and you could just go sit with him and listen to him tell the stories about all the old races, and we'd go to dinner at night. He'd get to talking, and he probably wouldn't like for me to tell you this, but we were talking about Secretariat and him beating Secretariat twice. And he was very proud of that. We had a few martinis, and he looked at me and says, "Wonder why they didn't put me in that movie."
Such a character. Yeah. And one of the true good guys in the sport of thoroughbred racing. You certainly miss. There's no doubt about it. When you think about all the other moments that you've been part of, what are some of the moments that always stand out to you when you do think back on your career?
Well, there's been so many good ones. And the thing about horse racing, the career, when I won my first race, I was probably as excited as when I won the Dubai World Cup. But you always have to one-up yourself. You know, they have to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And, of course, I'd say the three biggest moments of my career were Dubai World Cup with Roses in May, which pretty much propelled my career, I would say, because you could win on the biggest stage and the biggest race with the whole world watching. And it wasn't an easy horse to train. And then the Preakness, of course. To win a classic is what we all do this for. I mean, the game's predicated on the Kentucky Derby and the Triple Crown. I don't care. The Breeders' Cup's spectacular. But still, when you go to the sales, everybody wants you to buy them a Derby horse. So winning the Preakness with Shackelford was pretty unbelievable. And then I think one of the biggest feats was Little Mike winning the turf at Santa Anita when he was supposed to be a miler. They couldn't go over a mile, and he was a grade 3 miler. And through that year, he had just continued to improve and get better and better. And then he got to the Arlington Million, which was a great race in its own site. But I always loved, always wanted to win Arlington Million ever since I watched the Bart and John Henry hit that wire together. As much as I love John Henry, I still don't think he won.
Somewhere John Sullivan is smiling.
Yeah. But to take him then, people said, "Well, he got away with slow pace," and he did it once. And then to go into the Breeders' Cup turf, take him from off the pace, and Ramon to ride such a perfect race and win, that was one of the biggest moments. And a little side story about that, fast forward 2 years, and Ramon, they had the greatest jockey days at Saratoga, which I thought was one of the best events I'd ever been to. They brought in almost everyone. I think Jerry Bailey and Pat Day missed, and everybody else was there. And I came out of the races, and Ramon was standing there, and he had been retired, I guess, a year and a half or 2 years at that point. And we started talking. He said, "You won't believe who I was standing with." He said, "I was with Angel Cordero, Lafitte, Pinkai, George Velasquez. They were just telling me stories and stuff." I kind of looked at him and said, "Do you not realize that you're ever bit the legend of racing that those guys were?" And he took a second, and he looked at me and said, "I think you're biased because we did something great together."
Wow,
and
great line.
That was a pretty cool moment, just the two of us standing there in the parking lot, and for him to feel about it the same way I did, because I still look up to him and idolize him. He was such a spectacular jockey, and he rode such a perfect race, and we're in the paddock, and we say, "Listen, we can't get in front of these two horses and win. Let them go." Not many people could have gotten Little Mike to turn off and sit behind those two horses for a mile and a quarter and take over the quarter pole, and then he just rode the hair off of him.
Yeah, that was spectacular. Loved him that day. One of the things I've always admired about you is you're not afraid. You have such a great confidence about yourself and your horses, and you never duck a race because of this horse or that horse. Talk about that a minute.
Some people call it stupidity. it's a good story to that, too. Wayne Lucas told me one time, a long time ago, Wayne and I started flying around the country together as soon as I started flying horses, and had a few decent horses. He said, "I've made millions of dollars running horses where people said I didn't belong." He said, "Never be afraid if you think your horse is doing well to run him. Run him. Don't make him prove it. Don't make him go through all the conditions. If he's doing good enough and you're confident, run him and see what happens." And I have been fortunate enough that good things have happened along the way. And sometimes you look stupid. Sometimes you look dumb, but nobody remembers that. They might read about it the next day and laugh at you, but they'll always remember Little Mike winning that mile and a half when they all thought he should be in the mile.
you were so confident before that race. I remember visiting with you. You were outwardly confident, and in the interviews you came across very confident. What was it about Little Mike going into that Breeders' Cup that gave you the confidence?
Little Mike was a special horse, and you know, before the year earlier, I would say we had to be in the mile. But he had changed. He had just gotten better and better. And then the mile had the horse of the year in it. We did Wise Dan. I didn't see how we were going to get in front of him and outrun him. And it took a lot of thought about where to run him. And we ran back in the mile and a half. He was just a good horse, doing really good at the time. And if he could lay third, the race set up for him. But this will give the ups and downs of horse racing. I think I ran six or eight in that Breeders' Cup day, and none of them had run well. And going into the dirt mile, I didn't think there's any way that Shackelford could lose this race. He was doing so well. And he looked up and down the field and handicapped. He can't get beaten here. So none of them would run good to Shackelford. And I saddled him with confidence and sent him onto the racetrack, and he stumbled to his nose. As bad as a horse could stumble leaving the gate, and spotted the leaders. You know, he's supposed to be on the lead. He spots them, you know, 6-10 lengths, and is chasing around there and never catches up. You can't catch up with the best milers in the world if you give them a head start. And then the next day in the paper, there's a picture of me and Jacob in the tunnel at Santa Anita where the horses come out. I made it talking to the jock halfway down the tunnel. There was a bench. I just had to sit down and decompress for a second. He's sitting there with me. He knows by then not to even talk to me at those points. He just sits there. And believe me, it's comforting having him. And we're just sitting there thinking, Jake, we're not going to get a penny out of this Breeders' Cup. It's over. He said, we got one more chance, and you like this horse. Get your head up and get back in there and saddle that horse. And then the next thing, Little Mike does something that's spectacular, and it's the ups and downs of thoroughbred racing.
Yeah, so by the way, that's your son, Jake, that you're talking about. Jacob. How old was he at that point?
He was probably 21 now, so what, 16, 15?
16, yeah.
But he's the one that could get me straightened out and back in there and keep fighting. And it just shows you could be down one moment and up the next.
Let's talk about Shackelford for a minute. I know we talked several times around that Preakness Stakes before he won that race, and then after the race you were kind enough to join us on the program. Tell me about being around Shackelford. You became emotional when you would talk about him.
Yeah, Shackelford was – he was special, and he's showing it now the way his babies are running. He came into the barn from South Carolina without a lot of fanfare. I know he was an expensive RNA at the sale, and I was at Saratoga, and Tammy called me. She said, I think you got the horse you've been looking for in this horse, Shackelford. All right, I'll see when I get home. And then we get home, and he just really started doing well and getting better and better. And he had an air about him that you could just tell that he's all pumped up and all the time and just arrogant and cocky. But at the end of the day, you go stand in the stall with him 8 o'clock at night, he'd be as kind as he could want him to be. He was a total professional and such a great athlete. Patty El Prado was in the barn at the same time as the day of the Preakness. And he won off a long layoff, and he won the Dixie. It's the race before the Preakness.
Yep.
And we go back. He had been off for a long time. We go back to the barn to walk over, and the network's standing there to talk as we walk over. And I get a call. It said, Patty El Prado's limping in a spit box. Something's wrong with him. And if a horse runs like that and wins, and there's nothing, there's only about a handful of things. He either got real lucky and he bruised a foot, and it came up after he fractured a sesamoid, which is a little bone around the ankle. And then most of the time it's going to be a sesamoid. So I'm walking over. Then we get to where they saddle out on the turf, and he's jumping in the air and sweating. And then I get another caller saying on TV, he can't win. He's too hot. He's sweating. So nobody, I haven't been able to tell anybody Patty El Prado's broken down. He's jumping through the air and lunging and sweat running off him, and they're loading the gate. And then again, here he comes and brightens the day all over again.
Amazing.
There's so many little stories like that along the way with these good horses. But again, he stepped it up and elevated my career to a new level whenever he can win a classic. And there's a good – the Derby, I tell everybody, with Shackelford at least, I know what it feels like to think you're going to win a Derby. he turned for home on a lead and made it to the eighth pole, but he was laying it down and giving all he could, and then the three of them ran by him, and one of them being Animal Kingdom. But that's another one of the great moments of my career. So after that, there's 150,000 people there. They're all watching the race. They're all cheering, and if you have a horse in the race, you got to get down and check your horse. And it doesn't matter where you finish in a Derby. I haven't won it yet, but I've been as close as third twice. You just feel miserable. And you go from being the king of the world, everybody wanting to talk to you. You can't find a friend. Everybody runs to one person. But I come down the steps behind the grandstand at Churchill, and there's hardly anybody there. And I run into Graham Motion, and he's teary-eyed. and going the wrong way. And he just won the Kentucky Derby. I said, Graham. And he came and we hugged. And I said, you're going the wrong way. And he said, you got to take me where I'm going. This is your place, not mine. And he grabbed the back of my jacket. And by then, the crowd started coming around. And I just led him on down into the tunnel. I said, go get your horse and go across the track there.
Wow.
That was a pretty special moment in my career to see how excited that he was for winning the Kentucky Derby. And he's another good friend, as we talked about friends earlier.
As a guy from Louisville, I know how much it means, the Kentucky Derby means to you. I know how much you want to win it. But put that in perspective. Where is that on your bucket list?
Well, I mean, that's on top of everybody's. But, you know, so much is made out of me being from Louisville and wanting to win the Derby. But I don't care where you're from. If you're in this game for any length of time, you realize what greatness that is and how great it is to win the Kentucky Derby. And you want to do it. Now, I think it would be great for the city. I think it would be big for the city. I've got so many supporters there, and so many family, so much family and friends. And, you know, everywhere you go, people say, it'll come. You'll get one of a Derby. And I just think it would be great. I think it would be a fun night in Louisville, Kentucky, if we won a Derby.
What about this year? You got a couple horses. This could be your year. It's very wide open. I mean, you've got a couple horses that are alive.
You know, you look at last year. There wasn't one horse really fall off the Derby trail. And I had Jerry Wine that runs third in the Bluegrass. I would have loved to run in the Kentucky Derby. He didn't get in because the points were so high. And then you look at this year, and it's the deck is shuffling every week that we have prep races, and horses are falling either the wayside from injury or from lack of wanting to train or do different things. And it's so up in the air, anybody can win it. And I've got two good chances with Impressive Edge has to prove this Saturday in the Florida Derby that he can step up with the big boys and that he can run two turns. But, you know, he's showing me, from all indications I see around him around the barn and how he's run over at Gulfstream, that he can do anything. And then J-Boy's Echo is definitely on an upward trajectory and doing getting better and better all the time, every single day. And he has one more race to go. Work here on Saturday. He flies first class on the plane on Sunday and gets back to Kentucky. The Bluegrass next Saturday. And then we go into the Kentucky Derby to all the hoofla.
Yeah, and the Bluegrass looks like it's coming up a bit salty.
Bluegrass is going to be salty, and, you know, it may not be the place I would go if I didn't already have enough points, I think, to get in. But with the points and it being close to home and the big picture 4 weeks later, I think it gives us the best opportunity to win the Kentucky Derby.
Talk about that, Dale, because when the point system was introduced, some trainers loved it, some trainers really didn't care for it a whole lot. You had to get to the Kentucky Derby or try to get to the Derby before the point system when it was based on graded stakes earnings. Now you have to try to get there based on the points. How much has your approach changed?
Not much. And it hasn't affected, I don't think, the Derby in any way. I think all it does is give Churchill Downs more power over all these other racetracks on whether or not they assign points to your race. And that's why I didn't like it. I didn't like it being put in place. I didn't see a problem with the original way of doing it. I didn't see very many horses that ever got left outside the gate that belonged.
Yeah. Do you like the fact that they open it up to Japanese horses now?
No, I think all that stuff is so silly. And, you know, there's only one reason to do all that is to get all the money bet in Japan or from Dubai, wherever the horse comes from, to get the outside the country money into the wind pool. But it's tough enough to get into that gate with 20 horses, and now when they're cutting us down to 18 in America, it makes it a little tougher.
Yeah, it doesn't look like either one of the Japanese horses is going to run this year, so I'm sure a lot of people were happy about that. You probably one of them because you need points. I agree with you. I thought that the old system was fine. I didn't think it really needed changing, but the power thing is for sure.
That's the only reason. And you can look at last year, I think they took the points off of Sam David. And,
yeah.
And that's because they were, you know, in a business match with Tampa and Calder. And then, you know, to not give the Illinois Derby points, it's just ridiculous. And that's because of the Arlington Hawthorne beef. And the Derby is bigger than that. The Derby's not a tool to be used as a weapon. It drives the whole industry, and the people at Churchill need to realize what a responsibility to the game they have to preserve that right. And when you use it as a weapon, you can plan on being attacked by a weapon. And everybody says, well, the Derby can't go away, but nobody can tell you who won the Indianapolis 500 last year. And
Dale
we
Romans.
Said the same thing about it earlier.
Dale Romans with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Dale, going back to J-Boy's Echo for a minute, look back on that Gotham. What was your take on that performance?
Well, it was a great performance. First of all, let's go back to the Withers, the race before. When we shipped him up there, a 10-horse field draw the outside post, and they walk around the whole race, and we end up on the outside and lose ground everywhere, run further than everybody, and run third. Nobody says, well, he didn't win because they went slow. So then we come back for the Gotham, and they do set a fast pace. Probably the first clean trip. his entire career in all five starts. You go back and look at him, he was in trouble. Even the race he won, he gets knocked down, gets up and wins by five at Keeneland. But the Gotham was run fast, and the horses on the pace probably couldn't have kept going. But he engulfed them before they should have been fading from getting weak from going fast. He was on their hip at the 3/8 pole, headed to quarter pole. Now, you would have think those the quality of horses like were in that race could have carried themselves a little further even though they were going fast. So I don't think that it was much the pace as he's just coming around and doing things the right way now.
What have you seen since that race that makes you think he's going to move forward?
You know, he's a funny horse when you watch him train because he's a little bit lazy. But he's starting to get a little bit more aggressive and a little bit more into what he's doing. And he's traveling so smooth right now that he's going the right direction. I mean, those two races under his belt, he's 100% fit. He doesn't like to work fast. If I put him with company, he'll work fast. Going by himself, he works slow. But how much does he really have to do? He's plenty fit. He's had these two route races, and we're ready to go into Bluegrass. I might squeeze the lemon a little more going into the Derby to get to mile and a quarter. I think he's a horse that can get the distance. I don't think he has to come from way out of it. He's not a plotter. I think if they go slow, he can go fast. He can sit back and come running.
You said earlier that when you go to the horse sales, everybody wants you to buy them a Kentucky Derby horse. What does a Derby horse look like?
Well, we try to build a profile going into the sale, and you go through the book and do a pedigree analysis. Which you're going to buy a Derby horse, let's say there's 30,000 foals. You need 20 out of 30,000 to get to go. So we'll go through and throw out all the fillies. That should cut you down 15 out of 20. Then you go through and throw out all the true sprint pedigrees. That'll cut you to 10,000. So you got 20 out of 10,000. Now you're cutting out most of the breed programs because aren't many of those going to get there. Then. And that leaves you, and you get down to a smaller group. And then what we do is we'll have a group of shortlisters go out and look at every horse that's on our list. That cuts it down even further. Then I like to come through and look at them all with some friends of mine, and we'll decide which ones we really need that we really like out of that group. Then we do a full cardio exam on them to make sure that everything's a negative prediction. We'll negatively predict that they can't get them on a quarter or that their cross doesn't work on pedigree. We negatively predict that they don't get there. They're thrown out. Then we do the cardio as a negative prediction. We won't buy a horse because he has a good cardio. But if they don't have a cardio that looks like a Kentucky Derby profile, which some of the people use have huge databases that we compare them to, those horses are all thrown out. And then what you're left with is vetting for the horse, make sure that the skeleton's all in good shape, that the airway's in good shape, and then it boils down to price point, how much you have to spend. And if we can get any of those horses left in the pool, we feel like we got a chance to have a Derby horse. And that system has gotten us there 7 times in the last 10 years.
It's a lot of factors to consider. Does anybody ever really know for sure?
You don't know.
There's
that's
no expert.
That's why you do a negative prediction. It's easier to throw out what can't get there and buy something out of the pool of what's left. You know, you can know this horse isn't going to get there. So you start peeling the onion back and peeling them until you get to, and it's still a phenomenal feat to be able to get there. And I was talking to Bill Parcells this summer about buying horses. It's no different than going to the combine. You want to see how many times a guy can bench press 225 pounds and how far he can run 50 yards. And we do this as much combine practice at the sale as we can to see if they have a triple crown profile.
We're going to continue this visit with trainer Dale Romans from Gulfstream Park here in Hallandale Beach, Florida. We'll do that next. Stay with us as Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Nominate your yearlings now to the Fasig Tipton Summer Selected Yearling Sales. These sales are the top 3 yearling sales in North America by rate of return. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky, July 10th and 11th. The Saratoga sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 7th and 8th. And the New York Bred sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 12th and 13th. Selected sales, superior results. Nominate today at FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To to race the best.
Super Saver Russell Meyer, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Roses in May led, 300 meters left to go. Choctaw Nation coming after him, trying to close the gap. Then Jack Sullivan and Dynama. Roses in May, the leader, 150 meters out. Choctaw Nation a length and a half away. Roses in May holding Choctaw Nation and Dynama. And for Roses in May, it's Gallants in March. Roses in May first, Photo second. Dynama of Choctaw Nation, then Jack Sullivan. Congrats to Judy Minso, King's Boy, Lundy's Liability, Yardarm, Ruler's Court, Chickwooden, and El Bustanza.
Terry Spargo with the call of that 2005 Dubai World Cup. Roses in May, providing Dell Romans with a memorable victory, and a victory that, if you heard in the first half of the show, one that Dell considers to be instrumental in launching his career, a career that has seen him win more than 1,900 races. And he is our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here tonight. Welcome back. And by the way, quick update here from Fasig Tipton. Some news coming out this past week. September 10th, that's a date you want to circle on your calendar. Fasig Tipton adding a brand new selected yearling sale to their auction calendar here in 2017. It is the Turf Showcase, which is a sale consisting of yearlings suited for the turf. And again, September 10th at Fasig Tipton's Newtown Pike, Newtown Paddocks in Lexington, Kentucky. Don't miss it. Should be a good one. I'm looking forward to that, JT.
Yeah, that's going to be a great sale. And Dale, you need to get your system out there for the turf horses, maybe win the English Derby.
I love turf horses. Kitten's Joy.
Right around the same time as Roses in May, right?
Yes, they both came into the barn at the same time. And those stood side by side their entire careers. By the way, you brought chills to me listening to that again. That was a fabulous night, and it was a tough time in my career. And I can tell you that story.
Yeah, how come?
That's when my stable had an outbreak of strangles. And I had 90 horses down here, including Kitten's Joy, that was coming off of a knee surgery after his year of winning the Eclipse Award. And it was traumatic. We were in quarantine, and everybody was saying that, you know, I brought the end of Florida racing, and we couldn't get the 90 horses out of the barn. Money was shrinking because I'm not making any purse money. We're trying to get them all through it. And strangles is a bacteria that will jump from horse to horse quickly. And so the whole barn has to be quarantined. Fortunately, we only had one fatality out of it. It could have been a lot worse. And so we're nursing them along. But just before the outbreak starts, we get send Roses in May, goes to Dubai. And Roses in May had been a horse that had had some problems along the way. That's why he didn't get started late. He had a tendon injury. And Todd Fletcher had him as a two-year-old. And he sent him home for rehab on a tendon. I guess he went back to Todd, sent him home again for some more rehab. And Ramsey's a guy that if you have a horse, you got it. You don't have to worry about sending it home and it coming back to you.
Right, okay.
It's going to come back. But this was a case of nobody knew for sure the horse was going to make it. Instead of sending it on to New York, I had gone to Ocala and looked over all the new babies and just started working for Ramsey. And I called and said, I would like to have that big bay colt that's a three-year-old. You know, he needs to get off the smaller track. He said, okay, you can have him. And he says, can you go to the cull barn and look at the horses that were selling with no guarantee in the April sale? It's a long story. I backed it all the way up. I said, I can do that too. So I just happened to be, when I called him about Rosa May, right where the cull horses were, or else I just keep on coming probably and don't even stop there. There were five of them. And I pull in. The girl that was selling them happened to be at the barn, and she pulls out four horses that just needed to be sold to someone else. And this big, pretty chestnut stomps out. So I get back on the phone. I said, why are you selling the chestnut? I said, of all the two-year-olds, you had bought 50 of them that year. I said, this is my favorite one. Why are you selling him? And he said, because he had a little bit of a crooked knee. I said, whatever you do, put a reserve on him and keep him. He's your best two-year-old. That was Kitten's Joy. So that trip to Ocala changed my life completely. So then fast forward to Dubai, I mean, of course, you know, Kids Joy Goes On wins the champion turf horse as a three-year-old.
Yeah, so many elements that Kitten's Joy story, because when you hear Ken tell the story of how Kitten's Joy came to be, going all the way back to the dam
where she had to have cesareans and
amazing
how they fought to keep her alive with a fractured pelvis, and you know, his sister was a good horse. That you could write a book just on Kitten's Joy. But then so Rose and May shows up with him. They come in at the same time, and we start, because he ended up going through the sale. Somebody bid $95,000. Ken had a $100,000 reserve. Of course, his hard head wouldn't come down. The guy that was trying to buy him was just as hard headed. It wouldn't go up, and we ended up keeping him. And so $105,000, one more bid, and history's totally different.
Wow.
So then Rose and May, we start him out. He has a good three-year-old year. He probably makes $70,000, $80,000, and he's one of the favorites in the Indiana Derby. Come in that morning, and that tendon's hot again. So send him home. He comes back at 4. And I've never had a horse do this before. I probably never will again. He worked 3/4 of a mile here out of the gate in 10. 110. I said, this is phenomenal. He goes to Keeneland, wins by 11. Goes to Churchill, wins by 10. Take him to Cornhusker, he wins that. Goes on to win the Whitney, my first grade one. And then, you know, goes on and on and into the Breeders' Cup. He runs second to Ghost Zephyr. And then the next year, we're going to bring him back, and we're going to run him in the Don, Dubai. We run him in the Don, and he gets beat. He ran second. As we leave here scratching my head, how does he get beat? Ends up St. Liam is the one that beat him, ended up horse of the year.
Yeah, he was pretty good.
He was pretty good. But he was just –
funny how you don't know that at the time.
At the time,
though, right?
He was on his upward trajectory. So we were – at the time we were recording all their airways, and still do a lot of it, with a recorder – quarter in a set of blinkers with a microphone in front of their noses. We worked them, and you can listen to their breathing back on a voice analysis machine and get a whole printout of how their airway's working. So we worked him after the Don, and the guy reads it, and he says he's starting to lose his wind. He said he's getting to where when he gets under 12-second eighths that you can tell that he's holding his breath, and the flow's not as smooth. That's probably why he got beaten. It just so happened, that was about an hour before I talked to him, I put him on the plane to Dubai. So I said, well, we got to go. We're going. So I get over there, and I'm not realizing how big this whole situation is, Dubai World Cup night. And I've never told this story. So we're training. He's training spectacular. The press is following him in and out. It was a little bit different then than it is now, where everybody's out there in the same place. And he's doing so well. We work him under the lights at night, and there's a whole group of people, I don't know how many, 1,000 maybe, watching him work. I mean, he went down there like a – he looked like a black Ferrari under the lights, just zipping by, and worked as pretty as a horse can work. The morning of the race, we're going to jog him because they're not going to run until that night. And we go in, and groom's getting him ready, getting the tack all ready. Go check his legs. The tendon's got some heat in it again.
Ooh.
So I got 90 horses quarantined in America. I got the entire world press of horse racing waiting on him to come out and jog, and I about pass out in the stall right there. And so I feel of it, and I walk out, and I tell the press, I've changed my mind. We're just going to walk today. We put him in ice, and I started walking through the desert. I think I got halfway to Iran. Thinking, what am I going to do here? What am I going to do? And I start thinking about all the old horses my father had with tendons, and they never really bothered them. They may not run on it, but it wasn't a catastrophic situation. And I called Ken Ramsey, and he was good about it. He said, well, you do what you got to do. It's up to you. You're the only one who can make the decision. Stood him in ice for a long time. And then my assistant and I sat underneath of him. We'd alternate 10 minutes just rubbing it in alcohol, getting a massage, trying to get some blood flow into the tendon, get it tightened back down for one last hurrah. And then did him up in a poultice. There's no medication. And I went home back to the hotel and tried to take a nap. That wasn't working very well. So got up and drove back in, and we washed the poultice off of him about feed time. And you could tell that it started to tighten back up. It looked a little bit better. But I knew the injury had to be back or coming back. So I called Ken. I said, Ken, we're going to run. I said, but there's a chance, you know, that he's just going to gallop around behind the field and it's going to bother him. And I said, God forbid if something was to happen worse and he breaks down the racetrack, I'm never going back. I'm buying me a burka and walk around like a tall, fat Arabic woman the rest of my life.
And there's a visual.
Yeah. And so we're back at the barn. And back in the old racetrack was a little – they're both far away, but it was probably 3/4 of a mile over there. And we're sitting in the back in the dark with Rose and May at the barn. And I can see the lights, like a light, oasis of lights across there. And you can hear all the music playing and all the stuff going on. And they came and picked us up in a van. I told them, I want a private van. I don't want anybody on there with us. And we get on by ourselves. And I can still wake up at night sometimes I hear that hum of that van driving up to the grandstands. And it was the groom and me and him in the back of the van. And they dropped the ramp over at the paddock. And you walk out. And, I mean, bulbs start going off like Paris Hilton getting out of a limousine. And saddle him up. And they take us up to this one place to watch. And there wasn't, you know, three boxes over. There's the Mactoon family sitting there watching the race. We're 5-2 in the richest race in the world. I've been told that he's lost his win, and his tendon's bothering him again, and 90 horses in quarantine at home. And we told Johnny, just go fast. Don't slow it down, because if you go fast, he's got the stamina that they won't catch up. They'll stop, he won't. And as you just saw, Choctaw Nation runs up and looks like he's going to run right by me. He just hits the wall, and we hang on and win. And all the blood runs out of my head. And I try to run down there, and I want to get to Johnny. Cause just in case he was off a little bit, I want him to walk him back. And I hook this shank on one side. I'm walking back with him, and a little girl sticks a microphone in my face and says, "You seem very emotional after this win tonight."
You have no idea.
I'm thinking to myself, girl, you have no idea what's going on. So then we get our picture taken, and we go through the press conference. And the night ends with him in a round pen in a sand pit and me standing there watching him. And I said, "Buddy, you bailed me out for life. You'll never have to run again. And you got a lot of girlfriends coming." So thank you very much. And he got sold to the Japanese and went to Stan Stud over there. He never had to run again. And he's been a pretty good sire in Japan. A lot of winners, not a lot of top horses. But he bailed me out.
Yeah, what a great story.
Went home and ate a cheeseburger with Javier Castellano at the bar. At the hotel. Javier had won a $2 million Golden Shaheen, and that was kind of the start of his, you know, emergence onto the big scene.
Wow. Amazing day. Roses in May back in 2005, and special night for Dale Romans, who was our special guest here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Dale, you mentioned that's the same time that Kitten's Joy came along, and then you had other big stakes races. I mean, CS Silk is a name that comes to mind, and Thorn Song, another one. There were so many others. Joint Effort is another one that was kind of coming after those. Who are some of the other horses that are always going to stand out to you?
Well, you know, Kitten's Joy was always my gold standard of the best horse I was ever around. And, you know, he was just, you knew you were in the presence of great. And that's one of the great, you said, what's the great thing about horse racing? You're in the presence of so much greatness. And I was in the presence of greatness of being able to be around him. And I stand at the barn at night at Churchill and just watch him move around the stall. Nobody around, and it's like watching Baryshnikov dance just when he just walked around the stall. It was amazing. But you could tell there was a different air about him. And I've had a lot of good ones since, but he's always been the gold standard. But then we come to this year with Not This Time. And it's one of the best things I ever had in my career and one of the worst. This is such a spectacular racehorse. He could do it all. He was the dirt version of Kitten's Joy and a two-year-old. And really a spectacular horse. And it was tough to get beat. And that was a great Breeders' Cup juvenile.
Tremendous.
Tremendous. And we almost ran him down. And I never saw the video, but they said I beat Jacob up in the box cheering for the horse to get up. Again, Jake's always there for me. But he comes to mind first because he's the most recent one that didn't really get to reach his promise. But I'm anxious to see what happens to him when he becomes a stallion. But then you got Sassy's Image was a great filly sprinter that my brother and I had together. And that was a lot of fun to go around with my brothers that also grew up in a barn. They went on to be an executive at R.J. Reynolds and own horses afterwards. And Thorn Song's an interesting horse. He's a horse that had two or three trainers before I got him and never fractured his back leg and had pins put in it. And Mr. Zayat sent him in to see what you can do. He wouldn't train. He wouldn't go around the racetrack hardly. He would always go the wrong way, and it was difficult. And it was – we would try to pick times. I tell the rider out there, if you feel like he's a day that he can breeze, go ahead and breeze him because we don't know what day he's going to be. But he would tell you at times. You know, you would see in his eye or how he would act out there. And as long as we let him do what he wanted, we could get him fit and just keep him happy, he ran. When we put him on the grass, he broke his maiden and went on to win two grade ones. He was a pretty special horse. But so much work goes into those that you never can relax and enjoy them.
Yeah.
Until after it's over. And that's what I did in an interview last summer. They said, what would you have changed? And I said, I would have relaxed and enjoyed it more. And that's the advice I give anybody coming up. It'll all work out. Just enjoy the good ones when you got them there. And
do you try to do that now?
I try. I don't think it's my nature much. Everybody thinks I'm so quiet and reserved. I just keep it all in.
It's a lot of sleepless nights and cheeseburgers with Javier Castellano.
Exactly. That's what it is. And, you know, Wayne Lucas used to tell me a story about winning the derbies and going home to his hotel and eating cheeseburgers. And I was sitting there at that bar at the hotel in Dubai with Javier, and I was thinking, I'm doing the same thing. We've got to learn how to enjoy this more.
What about a horse, not a famous horse, but a horse that you thought you did a really good job with that you were close to? You got one of those?
Yeah, there's been a few of those. I thought, okay, Thorn Song, he's not famous, but he's a Grade One winner. I thought he was one of the best jobs we ever did training. But Silver Max, I mean, he's a little bit famous.
Yeah.
But he was a $20,000 yearling. And he was owned by a group of friends of mine since we were in high school, and a couple of people that work in the industry. And we had so much fun with him. And he was just a little engine that could. And it was fun to have him. He won 12 races. I don't know if I ever had a horse win at that level that many races. He just showed up, and he's one of those horses you push the pedal leaving the gate, and he was still there at the eighth pole. He would just go as far and fast as he could go all the way around there. And he beat a horse of the year. He beat Wise Dan at Keeneland.
Yeah.
And that was pretty spectacular. The Court Visions race, when he beat that field of milers in the Breeders' Cup mile, that was about as good a field ever put together. And I felt like we could win, and he paid $107. But I handicapped that race, and everybody in there from Goldakova on back, they were all the who's who, but they all looked like they had reached their tops to me. And they all looked like they were just heading down just a touch. And Alvarado had worked him for us, and he had just been getting better and better and better. He worked him for me, and he came back when he'd been working him his whole life. He said, best he's ever worked in his life. And I said, well, he might not be as good as he once was, but hopefully he's good once as he ever was.
Yeah.
And he got up by the nose and beat that good field. I thought we did a really good job with him.
I can remember thinking back on Silver Max for a minute, and he was part of that magical year that you had in 2012, mm-hmm. where you won the Eclipse Award at the end of that year. Take me through that year for a minute. What was going on that was so successful that year?
I don't know. I look back on it and I said, it's just the perfect storm. Again, it's not something you could have planned or expect, and things just kept happening. And that brings up another good horse that we talked about, Dullahan, that he was a big part of that year. And the reason I'm going to bring him up now is you know, he's the only horse, he may be the only horse in history who's won three races, all three Grade Ones, even broke his maiden in a Grade One, and all three were on Polytrack.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was in his life. So we shipped him out to the Pacific Classic, which was one of the biggest thrills I've ever had. And Shackelford was at Saratoga with me. But Shackelford, every once in a while, would get a quarter cracks, and he was developed a quarter crack. And I felt like I just didn't want to leave Saratoga and work on him. Sent Tammy to Pacific Classic with Dullahan, which she can handle everything on her own. And went back with two of my friends. We ordered a pizza. We had a 12-pack of beer, and we sat in my little cabin overlooking Saratoga Lake and waiting for Del Mar to run and watch that race. And that was the place about fell down. I don't get very loud when my horse is running, but the place was shaking when he was coming down the lake. all three of us got up and started riding him pretty hard.
You won't cheer when you're watching?
Not very often I don't, but in some of these big ones lately, it's been popping out of me. I've yet to watch I can't watch the replay of the Juvenile last year yet, so I want to see. They said they showed me beating on Jake, but I want to see that.
Poor Jake.
Yeah.
The whipping boy.
Dale Roman's with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazig Tipton. So what does it take to be a good horse trainer and to do it at this level for so long?
You know, I don't know. I don't, because I really haven't spent a lot of time with other trainers in the barn working with them. And I know with me, we've got a core group of people that have been with me since I started 30 years ago. My assistant's been with me ever since then. Tammy's been with me ever since then. I've got grooms. So my average tenure, I think, is over 10 years. My hot walkers don't leave. And I think it's just consistency. Your horses talk to you. Just listen to them. And it's been a big group effort for a long time. And like I said, I never expected to be at this level. I would have been happy with 20 head of horses like my dad had, claiming and trying to just get by. And like my father said, it's not a measure of how many races you win, how big a race you win, how long you last, and can you feed your family. And as far as that's gone, I've been pretty successful.
Yeah, that's good advice. When you get up every day, and you've got a nice bunch of horses to look at. It makes your job easier. What happens when it's not so great and you got to go? How do you get motivated to do that?
I'm looking for that perfect day. I'm still looking for that day that I go in and there's not an injury. For the day you go in and everybody trains good, everybody ate up, nobody's sick. For the day that we run four and all four of them win. And it hadn't happened yet. And maybe one of these things. Yeah, because, as you know, training horses, you can have 30 horses, you can have 100 horses, and the good ones are easy. But your focus is on the ones you're trying to make good or trying to fix problems or trying to nurse around there to get them. And that's the bad part, because you're always thinking or looking at the negative side of stuff. But one of these days we'll have the perfect day.
Would you tell me, Jude, the worst six words you can hear as a horse trainer are, "Hey, boss, come take a look at this"?
Yeah.
I guess that's seven words.
Yeah. There's nothing worse because you know.
Yeah. Well,
the horse just didn't have a baby or something.
Yeah. It's like, I told you guys a story. I won the Eclipse Award, and it was great. And 2012 was so good. But I know I'm a realist. I know there's never going to be another 2012. I know we're not going to win nine grade ones, and we're not going to have Shackleford and Dullahan and all those horses at Little Mike all at the same time in the barn. So we came over here and it was announced, and it was a big, big deal for me, and I was very excited about it. Got the trophy, and Tammy and the kids stayed out at the party, and I went home and I set it on the bed on the table, and I started looking at it. This is when the credits are supposed to play. This is when you're supposed to live happily ever after. But I got to go tomorrow and look at both tenants and check temperatures.
Yeah, it doesn't end.
No, it doesn't end. But that trophy's done me some good. She started yelling at me one day at home, Tammy did, about taking out the garbage or something. I just picked up my trophy and walked around a little bit. she said, "You're not funny, you're not cute, and it's not 2012. Take that garbage out."
What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, right, exactly.
All right, well, take us into the Del Romans home. What pictures, what memorabilia do you have around the home?
There's actually quite a bit, and we don't have a trophy case. And the kids always said, "You need to build a trophy case. You need to build a trophy case." And I always felt like, and I never told them, that it was almost a jinx if I built a trophy case, because maybe I wouldn't get any more to put in it. But just before I came down here to Florida, and nobody was home, and I kind of just started walking around looking at them all. And at the time, I don't know that that stuff was as important to me as it should have been. And when I look at the pictures of the – right now, I think I just basically keep mostly the graded stakes and the kids. And it shot of – you know, that's the whole movie of our lives, watching it. And as they grow up and went and looked at Kitten's Joy at Arlington, and their kids are so small, and Bailey has a cast on her leg. So you think back when she broke her foot, and Jake falling off the chair when we were cheering for him, and all the trophies that are there that I never expected to get. The Arlington Million Trophy. Now, those things are my prized possessions, even though I didn't. You know, you always move on to the next one. We've got to do the next project. Got the next horse coming along. I don't know if when I turn 50 if I got a little more nostalgic or what, but they mean a whole lot to me.
Well, you brought up your kids a couple of times over the course of the past almost hour here with this show. What's it meant to have them alongside you with this journey?
They keep you grounded, for sure. You know, and like I said, one of the great things about racing is that they can come everywhere we go. And Tammy, she's a jockey. Her father was a jockey. Her father was a trainer. Her brother was a jockey. Of course, I trained and my father trained. And neither one of them cared all about working in the business. The races with us. They respect what we do. And they really like it. And they think that it's very cool. And to me, that makes us look cool to them. And that's just about as good as a parent can have it.
What do you think you'd be doing if you weren't training racehorses?
I don't know. I've thought about it an awful lot. It can't be as good as what I've had. I don't know what it would have been, but it wouldn't have been as good as what I've had. And I've been very fortunate, and I realize it. And I realize how special this game is and how special the horses are and how they've been to me and my family.
I know you're a sports fan. I know you're associated with some notable sports personalities, mm-hmm. and you've gotten to meet so many people in other professions over the course of your career. Tell me about a couple of those other people that you had pleasure.
That's a great thing. I just, yesterday, Rick Pitino bought into another horse that we have. Which, you know, everybody in Kentucky idolizes Rick Pitino, and I do too. And Jay Gruden, the head coach of the Redskins, and I own horses together with Paul Gunther, the defensive coordinator of the Bengals, and Dan Issel, and I own horses together, the great Kentucky Hall of Fame basketball player. And That's another great part about this game. You see so many people at so many different levels. And I got so many good friends that are just the hot walkers that come in that have been with me for so long. And they'll come in and sit around the office and just talk about what's going on in their countries and what their lives have been like and what horses have done for them. It just puts you in touch with so many different people around the country and around the world. I mean, where else am I going to get on a platform with the ruler of a country like Sheikh Mohammed to hand me a gold whip? I mean, what other industry or profession would that happen for somebody that grew up like I did, barely got out of high school from Shively, Kentucky?
Yeah, it wouldn't.
It wouldn't. It would not. And the racetrack is a great equals. Where would you go that you could have a billionaire looking at a TV screen and cheering next to a guy that's making $200 a week, and the two of them at the end of the race turn around and talk to each other about what just happened? It's a great equalizer, thoroughbred racing.
Only about a minute left before we have to wrap this one up. Dale, quickly, what's still left for Dale Romans to accomplish?
Oh, there's a lot of things to accomplish. There's always the next good horse to come along. There's always, of course, the Kentucky Derby's out there. And we'll just keep striving to get there someday, maybe.
A couple of good chances this year. Good
luck. A couple of good chances, and the main thing is I'm going to start relaxing and enjoy it more.
There you go. He's Dale Romans, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Dale, been an amazing hour. We can't thank you enough. You're so, so gracious with your time every time we ask. Thank you, my friend.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate
it. It's been fun. I know I left a lot of horses, a lot of people out. Don't anybody get offended. We love you all.
He's the best. Dale Romans here on HRRN. JT, just about set to wrap this one up. Don't forget, we are back this weekend with coverage of the Florida Derby. You're going to hear that coverage all presented by the Pan American Conference coming up in May. That's right before the Preakness. And then, of course, next week we head to Keeneland. We'll have coverage of the Bluegrass, the Wood Memorial, the Santa Anita Derby. We are barreling toward that first Saturday in May.
Yeah, next Saturday is going to be a huge day, and this Saturday as well. So we've got eight days of constant Triple Crown action.
And we'll remind people that if you did miss any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, you can head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen at your leisure, and be sure to follow us on social media as well, at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Fun here from Gulfstream Park on Trainer Talk tonight. Don't forget, we're back next Wednesday with a brand new edition. For our special guest, Dale Romans, for Jude Feld, and for our producers, Lee Delapina in our Lexington studio, and my beautiful wife, Michelle, on site with us, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time right here on HRN.